A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 41. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of Red Dwarf. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. And as Brian says, we are talking about a BBC science fiction comedy series called Red Dwarf, which ran from 1988 to 1999, over 8 series, 52 episodes in all, and lots of wacky fun in a science fiction setting. So there was quite a few changes as they ran through the 8 different seasons of Red Dwarf. So we're just going to quickly sort of rattle through some of the major changes in the timeline of Red Dwarf. We've mentioned the first 2 seasons already, which were very much the Odd Couple in space, with mainly focusing on Rimmer and Lister and getting comic relief from Holly, the computer, played by Norman Lovett, and by the character of Cat, who would appear briefly to show off his clothes or to eat something. And it was very much just set on Red Dwarf, and in particular just set really in their bunk room, as you say, the bunk room scenes.
They had very basic sets, and it looked very grey. You know, all the sets were grey, and they were wearing T-shirts or sort of simple cloth uniforms. It was all very basic looking and very grey. It was really a character comedy. They did have some fun with some sci-fi stuff in there, too, with some time travel and what have you. But it was primarily a character comedy based around a science fiction setting. And in fact, in the first series of Red Dwarf, they never leave the Red Dwarf at all. They don't introduce the idea that they might have another smaller ship they can go on. The furthest out you get is a scene or two where you have Lister or other characters in spacesuits on like a gantry walkway on the outside of the ship. But they never actually leave the ship. And then in the second series, they introduce a small sort of shuttle spaceship called the Blue Midget that they then can go other places on. So they start stretching it a little bit further in the second series, but it's still very much on that same sort of gray-looking feel with the character comedy with a sci-fi setting that it fits into. When they went into the third season, it was very much of a change because they had some more money in the series, but it looked a lot spiffier and a lot more expensive as a series because they made things a lot more colorful and they did things with the design to give it weight. And the Red Dwarf suddenly seemed like a much more real type of place. They introduced Crichton as a regular character, and they also introduced Hetty Hayridge as Holly and had a new version of the theme song. So they really changed things quite a bit, and it became a sci-fi series that was also a character comedy. It was no longer a character comedy that just had some sci-fi fitting into it. It was now both things in a very prominent way. It was really a sci-fi show with this great four-way character chemistry with lots of comedy in it.
As you say, that's when all the science fiction stuff really starts to come in, isn't it? All the time travel and the parallel dimensions and cloning or DNA swapping and all that stuff. They really start to have fun with it and explore all these different ideas. And the other thing is the costumes improve. And in particular, we get this sort of running joke starts to develop, which is Rimmer's costumes changing every series. So whenever they moved on to a new series, Rimmer would get a new holographic costume and they would become more and more sort of outlandish and bizarre. And he looks rather like one of the Gerry Anderson Super Mario Nation Thunderbirds characters in several of the shows.
We'll get to this later, but there are actually a few points of Gerry Anderson influence on Red Dwarf.
Having sort of expanded the sets and the setting with seeing more of Red Dwarf and more of other ships, they then sort of brought it back in a bit, and they actually managed to lose Red Dwarf. The crew lost the main spaceship, and with that they lost the computer, they lost Holly. There was no Holly in season 6 at all, I think, and they spend the entire season on a sort of called Starbug, which fits in one of the landing bays of Red Dwarf, and they spend most of the season chasing the Red Dwarf ship through space, but along the way they keep getting diverted, and whenever they seem to be catching up with the main ship, something inevitably gets in their way. And then they, at the end of the season, they manage to encounter, in another one of the time travel paradoxes, they manage to encounter their future selves in a quite notable episode where they don't particularly get on very well with their future selves. And in fact, it appears that at the end of the series six, that they may actually have managed to kill themselves, to wipe themselves out in one of these time travel paradoxes that they love.
It was quite something. It was their first real season cliffhanger at the end of a series. The series, as you said, Eamon, at this point is set on Starbug exclusively rather than set on Red Dwarf. Starbug was a spaceship that was introduced in the third season, and it looked quite neat. It was this sort of insect-like thing that was like a series of three spheres in green connected to each other. It became more and more, from when they introduced it, the setting for Red Dwarf and what we see there. So it was sort of a natural step in season six that they went to not having the Red Dwarf there at all.
Did they do that, do you think, were there production reasons for switching down to Starbug?
I think the main reason was that they felt that they had exhausted what they could do with Holly as a character. They felt they had done the Holly jokes they wanted to do. They wanted to continue to do the series without Holly, who was played by Hetty Hayridge at the time, so it was the female Holly. So they set it on Starbug, which they liked Starbug as an image. They set it on Starbug so they could go forward without having Holly there.
Right, and it gave them new sets, I suppose, and new backdrops to explore.
Yes, they expanded the sets for Starbug. We got to see that it was actually a fairly spacious ship in and of itself, which showed you just how huge the Red Dwarf itself was. Then after season six had ended with this cliffhanger, Red Dwarf didn't come back for about 3 years. Series seven came out and they were still on Starbug, and they of course resolved the cliffhanger from the end of season six. Within the first few episodes, Rimmer leaves the crew. They have this great sequence that explains why Rimmer is gone, but Rimmer disappears. We don't have him anymore. And then we have Christine Kachansky, who was the love interest or potential love interest for Lister. She shows up again, or a version of her from a parallel universe that's still alive shows up. It's actually played by a new actress, so it's quite a different version of Kachansky. But what we end up with is a season of Red Dwarf where you have Kachansky in most of the episodes and Rimmer in a few of the episodes. It has a bit of a different feel, but it sort of continues from where things were from Series 6 with an even more higher budget type of feel than it had before.
Yeah, certainly the budget's increased for Series 7 and 8. And there were some changes, which we'll talk about in a minute, which made a difference. And as you say, we have Kachansky back. And we had the original actress who played the first Kachansky was the original Gregory's girl herself, Claire Grogan. But when she came back in Series 7, she was played by Chloe Annette. And she was an interesting character. It sort of took over that fourth character in the team while Rimmer was elsewhere doing other things. I suspect also partly while Chris Barry, the actor, was also away doing other things. And then we got to Series 8, the final series at the time of recording of Red Dwarf. And things got, you know, if you think the timeline's been complicated up to now, it became even more complicated because Crichton discovered that his very own nanobot repair robots, these microscopic robots that he had in him, had somehow escaped and that they had rebuilt the original Red Dwarf ship. And not only had they rebuilt the Red Dwarf ship, but they managed to restore all the original crew, including Rimmer, so that in Season 8, Rimmer returns and he's no longer a hologram. And not only has he returned, but the rest of the crew have returned and find it somewhat difficult to accept why they are suddenly 3 million years from Earth and unable to contact anybody else.
And why the design of the ship has changed slightly.
Absolutely, yes. Red Dwarf has a slightly improved and altered version to the original one, but still a vast vessel.
Red Dwarf 8 was a very unusual, different kind of season. It had a very different feel from the earlier ones. It was still based around that character chemistry, but you had a whole bunch of other characters who were suddenly there. And it had a very different feel. It almost felt like it was a spin-off for Red Dwarf. It did some neat things. It sort of brought back some of the original bunk scenes that you had in the first couple of series with Rimmer and Lister bickering. It brought some of that back, but still kept some of the other character chemistry. It felt a bit like a best of of all of the different types of things they had done with some of the, you know, with some new things thrown in. So it was very different, and a lot of fans have acted very negatively towards it because it was so different that in many ways it was not what they wanted. And as I say, I could have seen this being a spin-off or another series based on Red Dwarf. But it is an interesting one to see, and to see where you come down on the divide on it, because a lot of people really like it, and certainly lots really don't like it.
Yeah, we'll find out which side of the divide we come down on very shortly.
Me. It's all junk mail, yours, you know.
Me, me, me.
You send off for every bit of rubbish going, you do, just so you'll have some mail to open.
Me, me.
Please rush me my portable walrus polishing kit. 4 super brushes that will clean even the trickiest of sea-bound mammals. Yes, I am over 18, although my IQ isn't.
Me, me. Smeg! Outland Revenue?
Oh, 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 Outland Revenue!
8,500!
8,500! That's a lot of tax, isn't it, Lister? How on Titan are you going to pay for that, eh?
I'm not. It's yours.
What?
Now, this is wrong. It's wrong. That's well wrong, Lister.
Relax. It doesn't matter now. They're not going to catch you now, are they?
What do you mean? Just because we're 3 million years into deep space and the human species is extinct? That means nothing to these people. They'll find us.
So, the good, the bad, and the smeg of Red Dwarf. The bits that work well for us and the bits that perhaps not quite so effective. It certainly has, you know, as we've said already, this is a very distinctive science fiction humour show. I don't think there's really anything like Red Dwarf. Some of Hitchhiker's Guide comes close. I think Moments of Space come close. But it's pretty much out there on its own in front of science fiction comedy, Ryan.
I would tend to agree with that. One thing that we haven't mentioned till now, all of the series except for Series 7 were shot in front of a live studio audience. Now, there would be some segments of those that would be shot beforehand and the audience would be able to see them on screen, or the audience would see captions and they'd be shot afterwards. Most of those episodes were performed in front of a live audience and filmed with multiple cameras. So you would have like a laugh track for it, but it was actual live audience laughter. The characters would play to that. They'd wait for the laughter when they needed to and come in over the laughter when they needed to. They would play all of those things in just the right way, and that helped give you that really snappy sort of comedy.
But do they supplement that with a laughter track in places? I mean, as you say, some of the later seasons are not filmed with a live audience, but I think in some of the early ones they add in laughter track as well as the live audience reaction. Or is that just me?
I don't know for sure. I believe most of it was actually recorded at the time. There were a couple of situations where the laughter was so intense that the actors couldn't hear their own lines and they had to pause to wait for some of the laughter more than you normally would, or they would speak over it and then the lines would just have to be dubbed in afterwards so you could hear it. In particular, there was an episode that we've alluded to called Polymorph, where there was this strange genetically engineered creature that could morph into different kinds of things. And there was a sequence where it ended up turning into a pair of shorts that Lister put on. And the polymorph then started to shrink as these shorts. And Crichton had to try to get them off in a rather unusual way. And I'll just say that it looked like something else was happening. And it was a very funny scene. And one that had the audience in such laughter that it almost brought things to a halt.
Right.
It was only just because of the stage presence and the know-how of those actors that they got things going quite well without having to stop recording at that point. But a lot of what was there in that series was related to the fact that it was done live.
There's also this recurring joke they do through several of the series where Dave Lister has to kiss some bizarre or awful creature. Sometimes he thinks he's kissing an attractive woman, but he's actually kissing some sort of weird genetic creature. And sometimes he's just been attacked by some strange zombie-like monsters. As you say, clearly those moments were filmed in front of a live audience because the reaction to those is... again, I'm sure it was almost show-stopping each time it happens. So they work very well.
There is that one moment in Series 6 with Lister kissing this woman as he sees it, and we see him kissing this woman, and they do the big panoramic thing with the camera panning around in a circle looking at him, and then it crossfades to what we see he's really kissing. And it was, I won't go into too much detail, but it was very funny.
And the crowd love it, yes.
There were a lot of great episodes of Red Dwarf. Shall we talk about a few of our favorite episodes that stick out?
Let's do our favorites, yes.
I think for me, and this is one of the fan favorites as well, the season 5 finale was called Back to Reality. It was an episode where they're in this very strange situation with Starbug where they encounter something that appears to kill them. And we then get this message on screen that says, game over. And we get the impression that perhaps the entire series up till now has been a video game. And we're introduced to a series of the players, which of course are alternate versions of the Red Dwarf crew, including the original introduction of Dwayne Dibley. We get all this great stuff going on, and we do get the explanation for what's really happening. But it was really a very funny episode, and it played with multiple neat sort of sci-fi ideas that were just a riot mixed in with this.
Absolutely. I mean, you've picked my favorite episode as well. Back to Reality is probably the best moment in Red Dwarf. And as you say, when the characters appear to find that they've been playing a virtual reality game all this time, and when they find out that they're real versions of themselves are basically characters who they would, the exact opposite of what they ever wanted to be. And it's so well done, and it's so well thought out. It's just a fantastic episode with a brilliant cameo from the British actor Timothy Spall cropping up in there as well. It's great. I think also from the same series, there's an episode called Quarantine where the Rimmer hologram becomes infected with something called a holovirus and goes mad, and it introduces not only the mad Rimmer, but also a character called Mr. Flibble, and that was a very funny episode as well.
Yes, Mr. Flibble is a fabulous character, and you'll have to find some photos there. Mr. Flibble was basically a cheap hand puppet that was, through only very simple effects and some spectacular comic acting by Chris Barry, brought to life. That is also one of my favorites.
And we mentioned Dwayne Dibley's introduction, but also Ace Rimmer's introduction in the episode Dimension Jump. I just love Ace Rimmer whenever he turns up, but his first appearance in Dimension Jump is fantastic.
Yes. Again, great humor combined with all this really powerful sci-fi stuff that just made things work so well. Another one to mention from Series 4, Dimension Jump was from Series 4, also from Series 4, was an episode called Justice, where they end up going to this prison space station because they believe they may have a mad homicidal simulant on board, and they go to this station that has a justice field where nothing unjust can happen within this. Whenever you try to do something to someone that's unjust, it happens to you instead. And it's a fairly simple sci-fi idea, but they carried it out just in terms of the sci-fi quite well. But then adding in all the layers of humor they had with the character chemistry and the one-liners and all of their jokes in there, it was great stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. It's all fantastic stuff, certainly around that middle stretch of the Red Dwarf seasons.
Yes, there is some great stuff in the middle. I liked the early stuff, too, where you had episodes like Future Echoes, which was the second episode of Red Dwarf. And again, that was, I think, the first time, apart from the setup of the show, the first time they tried to tackle a fairly complex sci-fi idea, which was this idea of traveling faster than light and getting these echoes from the future. And they played with that in such a wonderful way. And again, using Chris Barry acting the same scene twice, but with Lister doing two different things in the different versions of it. Some really funny stuff and some great storytelling even back then as well.
Chris Barry is pretty good at acting against himself, isn't he?
He is.
Whether he's acting against a future echo of himself or whether he's acting against Ace Rimmer, he does that very well. But even when he goes mad and he becomes Mad Rimmer with Mr. Flibble, it's just his acting that sort of carries it off. It's fantastic.
Chris Barry did some great stuff as Rimmer. He was really very good. Danny John Jules as the cat also did a great job. And I really liked a lot of the one-liners and just the fun he had with it in the first couple of series, which, as we said, was a little repetitive and a lot of one-liners. But he was just so physical and so funny. It was really very good. And then when they developed his character into being a little more capable but still missing a lot of things that were happening and were being said, he was always funny and always a great feature of this show. I really enjoyed the cat whenever he shows up in more featured types of roles.
The humor throughout Red Dwarf is it's quite irreverent and rude throughout. I mean, you mentioned the episode with the shorts and the fun that produced when it was filmed in front of a live audience. And with, I think, you know, again, with another science fiction convention, they had to introduce some new words that they could use, I suppose, as swear words or profanities, which seems to be quite common in the science fiction universes. I mean, we've got frack elsewhere and other words, and Serenity and Firefly, where they swear in Chinese. And here, on Red Dwarf, they introduce words like smeg and smeghead, and then goit and gimboid, which Rimmer was very fond of using to insult people with.
Yes, Rimmer was always calling Holly a goit in the first couple of years. And if you want to know what smeg means, you'll have to look it up. I won't explain it. It's not original to Red Dwarf, but they certainly popularized
although
it.
They claim, perhaps, you know, perhaps falsely, they do claim that they didn't know the definition of the word before they started using it.
Wow. Interesting.
There's a very funny clip of Craig Charles and Robert Llewellyn on YouTube, where they're at some science fiction convention, and a very young fan asks them what smeg means, and they are far too embarrassed. They try to crawl off the stage rather than answer the question.
Yeah, they refuse to say anything. That's right. The style of Red Dwarf changed to a certain extent with the writing after Series 6, when there was that 3-year gap. Rob Grant actually left the writing team. So for the first 6 seasons, Rob Grant and Doug Naylor were writing everything together. They were really a closely bound writing team, sometimes called Grant Naylor. They went their separate ways after Series 6, and Series 7 and 8 were written by Doug Naylor, in some cases with other writers. So the style of things, the style of the humor, it changed a little bit. It was still good, but it did change a little
bit. Red Dwarf 7 and 8 are known to be different.
Yes, especially Red Dwarf 8. And I think it was in many ways a good move of making it so explicitly different rather than trying to continue on from Red Dwarf 6, where as soon as you hit 7, you had sort of the differences because of the writing. But as far as I'm concerned, from end to end, it was always funny. Even their weaker episodes were always a good laugh. It was always great fun seeing those characters bouncing off each other, and the character chemistry was always good, and every one of those lead actors had a good sense of that, and it really played well.
As we like to know British Invaders, we'll talk about some of the spin-offs and revamps and also remakes of Red Dwarf.
There were a series of novels that came out written by Rob Grant and Doug Naylor under the pen name Grant Naylor, and these 4 novels were based on some of the events of the TV series, but they were not novelizations of specific episodes. They would take a chunk of events over the course of part of Red Dwarf and change it. They'd modify it in certain ways, and they'd build that into a story rather than just being a series of individual stories. At least some of them are available as audiobooks read by Chris Barry, who played Rimmer, of course. And as we mentioned, Chris Barry was a great impressionist and impersonator, and he can do the voices of every Red Dwarf actor. There are some sample chapters from the audiobooks on some of the DVDs. So it's interesting just to listen to a little bit of that, to hear Chris Barry doing all of the voices for Red Dwarf.
And they're available on iTunes, certainly on the iTunes store here in the UK, I think. And then there was a Red Dwarf magazine, which was published between 1992 and 1994. And then got renamed, inevitably became the Red Dwarf Smegazine, which featured comic strips and articles about the series. And there was also a Red Dwarf role-playing game, which I know very little about, apart from the fact that they produced three different parts for it. There were three books. There was the rule book, a source book, and then there was like the Game Master's Shield or screen, which was the artificial intelligence screen, which came with various extra bits as well. So it actually managed to spin off into a role-playing game. I don't think it was ever, it ever became a computer game, although I know the fans certainly were asking for one, but I don't think that ever happened.
Did you ever read this magazine?
No, I don't think I've ever encountered this magazine.
No, I haven't either.
Again, you can find snippets of the comic strips online. And then after the success of Red Dwarf in the UK, inevitably, I suppose, it was picked up for an American remake. And a pilot was made, an American version, with a different cast, with only Robert Llewellyn as Crichton surviving from the British cast. So they cast Craig Bierko was to play Lister. And I think most notably in the first version, Jane Leaves, who plays Daphne on Frasier, played the computer character, played Holly. And they shot one pilot for American TV, as I say, with this different cast and also with different writers. But for some reason, that pilot didn't work, or the producers didn't like it at all. Grant Naylor didn't like it, and they took over and tried to write their own version. And that was partly recast. And they went so far as to shoot scenes for a second pilot, again, with a slightly different cast. They changed two of the actors for the second version, Brian, I think.
Yes. The US version of Red Dwarf really didn't go very well in terms of when they were trying to make it. It had been started already when Rob Grant and Doug Naylor got involved. They tried to fix the problems with it, then they wrote a new script. For various reasons, their script wasn't shot, and they went through all kinds of very odd back and forth with it. They tried to get Chris Barry on it as Rimmer, but he wasn't interested. They tried to get Danny John Jules, but he wasn't available at the time. They went through all of these different hoops, and eventually the thing just fell apart, and it was not broadcast. It was done between Red Dwarf 5 and Red Dwarf 6. The Red Dwarf 5 DVDs in some versions have some information in the documentary about that.
And you can find snippets of the American pilots on YouTube. Basically produced from bootlegs, I think, because it was never actually released. And as you say, it was just not successful. It was never picked up. But you can see bits of it and see why it really didn't work with an American cast.
There are some clips that are on the DVD, right, and those may be the ones that are on YouTube. Although I understand there is a bootleg floating around of the complete thing of everything they shot for those pilots.
Hades, I want to go to Blow Alert.
Okay.
Thank you. Bit of professionalism.
Wait, I've got something. I'm punching it up.
Too small for a vessel. Maybe some kind of missile.
It's impossible to tell at this range. Whatever it is, they clearly have a technology way in advance of our own.
So did the Albanian State Washing Machine Company. Step up to red alert.
Sir, are you absolutely sure? It does mean changing the bulb.
There's always some excuse, isn't there? Range 15,000 G-gooks and closing.
Direct collision course. Suggest evasive action.
Engaging reheat. It's still with us. It's some kind of heat seeker. We can't outrun it. That's it. We're deader than tank tops. Suggestions?
Sir, may I recommend I load myself into the reverse thrust tubes and you use my body as decoy fodder? This will, of course, leave me splatted across deep space and unable to complete today's laundry, for which I apologize in advance.
Crichton, stop your blathering and get in the damn tube. Crichton, sit down. I'm not doing my own smegging ironing. Look, maybe we can reason with it. Open communication channel, sister. Broadcast on all known frequencies and in all known languages, including Welsh. This is Acting Senior Officer Arnold J. Rimmer of the Jupiter Mining Corporation transport vehicle Starbug. Now hear this, because it's only coming once. We surrender, totally without condition. Thank you, guys.
Now, as we've mentioned before, Red Dwarf was revamped for the last couple of series, Red Dwarf 7 and Red Dwarf 8. It had been 3 years since Red Dwarf 6 had finished. Rob Grant and Doug Naylor, who had been working together for many years, Red Dwarf and earlier, they started to work on Red Dwarf 7 together, but for whatever reason it wasn't working, and that team broke up. Rob Grant left, and Doug Naylor did Red Dwarf 7 as writer on some episodes solo as the only writer, and on some episodes he had various different co-writers. That changed things somewhat. They also had a significantly bigger budget. They, I believe, moved to a larger rehearsal and filming studio. They dropped the live audience for Series 7 and went to working strictly on the studio floor. And then they backed off of that and went back to the live audience for Red Dwarf 8, which I think in some respects made for a definite improvement in Red Dwarf 8. They also started going to use of computer graphics and adding, you know, bigger effects and more flash and bang. So Red Dwarf, from beginning to end, I think keeps looking higher budget as you go. And it definitely looked a lot snazzier and a lot higher budget in the last couple of years.
The filming technique changed. It looks different, doesn't it? I don't know if the first ones were filmed on video and then film, or the other way around.
It does look different. I don't know of the details. A big part of it was the change to not having the live audience for Series 7.
Right.
That made a big difference. And then by the time they got to Series 8, the fact that they had the extra budget they had by then meant that it was a much more sophisticated process and they could do some things with newer technology. Those 3 years in between made quite a difference in what they could do. And of course, the budget was also a big change.
Yeah.
Now, there was also something called Red Dwarf Remastered. This came out in 1998 for the 10th anniversary of Red Dwarf. It was between Red Dwarf 7 and Red Dwarf 8, so they were at the stage of having lots of computer graphics and relatively big budgets. They rebroadcast series 1 to 3 in this new Red Dwarf Remastered format, which had computer graphics replacing most of the model work of the spaceship. Some of the spaceships they redesigned, the Red Dwarf looked a little different. Blue Midget, instead of being a ship that could go along the ground with treads on it, like tank treads, instead of that, it had legs now, so it was this big walking spaceship, as it also appeared in Red Dwarf 8. They refilmed some of the spots for Norman Lovett as Holly, and they added a couple of Holly jokes, and they cut a couple of scenes as well. Not many, but they did cut out a couple of scenes. All in all, it was not received very well. Most people felt that the original one was better. They liked the scenes that were cut out, especially if you know Red Dwarf, the black card, white card bunk scene. That was cut out in the remastered version. And all in all, Doug Naylor wasn't satisfied with it, and it didn't go over that well, so they stopped after doing 3 seasons. They had talked about doing 4, 5, and 6 as well, but they in fact didn't do those.
Right.
And of course, there's also the famous story of the Red Dwarf movie, which never happened.
That's been never happening for years.
Yes, as far back as I think around Red Dwarf 5 or so, or at least after Red Dwarf 6, they were talking about making a Red Dwarf movie, a full theatrical movie with the original cast, supposed to be a big deal, and it was in so-called development hell for a long time. And eventually, I believe after Red Dwarf 8, they decided that if they were going to do more seasons of the TV series, they were going to do them after the movie. So I think they were waiting for a movie, which was why finally, eventually, it became pretty clear that the movie wasn't going to happen. And by then, a lot of time had passed. And what it looked like was that was it for Red Dwarf.
But as we've heard recently, and as we talked about on the bonus show, Red Dwarf is back. As of 2009, Red Dwarf is returning. It was announced last year, I think, that there would be some special episodes of Red Dwarf made for a UK digital TV channel called Dave, and that the original cast were reuniting to produce Red Dwarf Back to Earth. And they are filming at the moment. There's been various versions of what we're going to get. To begin with, it seemed like we were going to get 2 special episodes and 2 sort of features, a documentary and an episode which was going to be Red Dwarf Unplugged with the cast reenacting some classic scenes from the original series. But I see more recently from, of all places, Robert Llewellyn's Twitter account that they're now, they've had to expand the actual story back to Earth into three parts, and that the unplugged episode may be pushed back to a later date. But we seem likely to get the three parts of Red Dwarf back to Earth in April of 2009, and it's scheduled also for a quick DVD release in June later this year. So that's coming up. They're back. The boys from the Dwarf are back.
And with any luck, maybe we'll see it show up in North America at some point too.
No news on a release date there, though.
That's right. But it is exciting to have this reunion show being launched. They have Craig Charles back as Lister. They have Chris Barry back as Rimmer. They have Denny John Jules and Robert Llewellyn as the Cat and Crichton. They're not bringing back either incarnation of Holly, and they're not bringing back Chloe Annette's version of Kachansky. So it will be those core four characters that the series was really centered around. So we'll see what that's like. As of this recording, we're still a couple months away from it.
So releases and availability of Red Dwarf over the years, certainly, I think, over here in the UK, and I think the same in North America, we've had various releases of all the different seasons of Red Dwarf as they've come out. So the years you've been able to get them on VHS and then individual seasons on DVD, and there's also been some, you know, grouping together box sets, but now they've released what they're calling the anniversary edition in region 2, which is all the eight seasons of the original Red Dwarf available in one box set, and it's presented in a very sort of large, what they call a photo album format, which features various photos from the production along the way, so you can get all eight seasons in one go, and that's currently going for about £35 on Amazon over here.
And does it include any extra features?
There's no extra features on that at all. It's just the 52 episodes. So some of the documentaries and making of features that appeared earlier on, you have to find those elsewhere. And likewise, you also can't get the rather famous outtakes and the various snafus and mix-ups that they made along the way, which are referred to as the smeg-ups. You have to get those separately on another DVD set for a tenner. But you can see some of those on YouTube, and they are hilarious fun in themselves. And then you can also, there is the Body Snatcher collection, which I haven't seen, but this was the Red Dwarf remastered that you talked about earlier on, Brian, where you can get the first three series in this slightly unusual remastered version with extra CGI and with some extra scenes put in and also some beloved scenes taken out rather strangely. So that's available. But as I say, if you want to get hold of the basic series, there's a fairly cheap way to get hold of it over here in Region 2 at the moment in the anniversary set.
In Region 1, there has only been one release of each series, and they did it as the complete Red Dwarf, and they earlier did it as separate individual seasons. So you can buy each season that's a 2 or 3 disc set, or you can buy the whole series, all of Red Dwarf, which is basically all of the season sets collected into one box. And that's currently selling on Amazon.com for something like $145. That is the set I have, and it has lots of extras. It has on the order of 3 hours of extras for each season. So every season has smeg-ups, every season has deleted scenes, every season has about a 90-minute documentary with interviews. And you have other things with different seasons. You also have things like individual recordings of the music and sample chapters of the audiobooks, raw, unprocessed effects shots, and things like that. So it really has a lot on it.
Okay, lots of stuff. So our recommendations for Red Dwarf, Brian.
Wow.
Right, well, I'll start us off. I think this Red Dwarf is a good example of a series that needed to be allowed to run and develop, because although there is lots of good stuff in the first two series of Red Dwarf, I think it's from the third series where they get the basic four characters that it really hits its stride. And in the middle of Red Dwarf, from series 3 until series 6, it is just the best bit of comedy science fiction that certainly has been on the BBC, if not that's been on British television. It's absolutely at its height between series 3 and 6. Personally, I don't like series 7 and 8. I didn't like the revamps. I thought it was a case of too much money actually spoiling the show. And I actually liked the earlier on shows when there was more model work and less CGI. And I thought that worked better. Again, there's good stuff to watch in 7 and 8, but I really like the middle parts of Red Dwarf. And that's, you know, if you're looking to start somewhere, then that's what I would recommend. But as it's so readily available over here in Region 2 at the moment, I would definitely say get this one. It's a fantastic show.
Yes, Red Dwarf is a classic. I really am a fan of it. I would recommend, if you have the time and the cash, absolutely watch Red Dwarf from end to end. I think everything in it is worth seeing. If you're not too big on the sort of Series 1, Series 2 type stuff, check out a bit of Series 3 or even a bit of Series 4, because it does take on more of the feel of a full-out sci-fi adventure show that's packed with comedy and really high-paced, dense episodes. And while there are some things in the last couple of series that are not quite the same, I like those last series as well. I enjoy pretty well all of Red Dwarf, with the exception of a few weak episodes here and there. It's good stuff. Watching it from end to end is really fun. I would say that DVD is the way to do it. Many cases in broadcast in North America, they have cut it down because 25 to 30 minutes is a little long for a half-hour slot, so they very often cut things out of it. The DVDs are great. They're widely available for rental in North America as well as for sale. So I definitely give this a strong recommendation.
Yeah, if you struggle with the first two, jump ahead to Red Dwarf 3. It really kicks off from there.
Yes. So, in summary, Red Dwarf is a sci-fi comedy series that takes place 3 million years in the future, after the Red Dwarf has had the massive radiation leak that has wiped out the entire crew, except for Dave Lister, who was sealed in stasis, and the cat who was in the hold, and the cat had then evolved into this entire species, including our character, the cat. Lister and his dead bunkmate, Rimmer, become a bickering type of odd couple, and you have this wonderful character comedy with solid sci-fi mixed in for a great adventure that lasts for 52 half-hour episodes.
Absolute comedy gold. Check it out. So, next time on British Invaders, we'll be talking about A for Andromeda, a science fiction drama from 1961. A very interesting show. We'll also be covering the sequel, The Andromeda Breakthrough, and a later remake. And it's almost a franchise, A for Andromeda. So, quite an interesting show to talk about next time.
Yes, we'll be shifting from comedy to something that is much more old-school, idea-based, solid, cerebral science fiction, which will be a good one to look at as well. It's a good series. So you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
And this is Eamon from England saying, smoke me a kipper, I'll be back for breakfast.